Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm, the first cheesemaking co-op in Vermont. For more information, visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a little cloudy, a Monday, and late summer now in Brooklyn. And, you know, we've been talking about for the last, decade or so about how print magazines, the print media in general, is in a serious state of danger. Newspapers and magazines are folding or shrinking, and subscriptions are falling, while online presence is really taking center stage for a lot of these publications. Yet, a small, brave new crop of smaller publications are unlikely kind of paving their own way, are paving their way with a very different new voice. And I wanted to talk more about that because I have the founder of one such amazing magazine called Saucy on the show right now. It's Kristen Taylor. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Saucy was started about a year or two ago?
About a year and a half, yeah.
And what would you sum it up as? I'm holding one right now.
So well, it's a crazy project. it's a magazine all about our relationships with food and each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's very visually stunning. So it's not, you know, it's seasonally themed.
Right.
So this issue's theme, the one that just came out, is on...
It's movement, actually. Movement. Yeah, and the whole thing is set in Miami. These are actually, every issue is theme-driven, as you mm-hmm. said. And I have some people say to me, well, where are the recipes? I said, well, there are some hidden inside.
I saw.
There are a few.
The ropa vieja?
Yes.
Yeah. It doesn't look like a recipe because there's no ingredients, step one, procedure. It actually looks like a poem.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. So I can read it as a recipe and mm-hmm. I really enjoy that. Mm-hmm. You know, why are all recipes kind of, I'm doing the drawing the square thing.
Yeah. It's fun to take it out of the grid a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole magazine for that matter too. I mean, it's not like you're following, best Thanksgiving recipes. Oh my God. How much do we have to see that? I'm like seeing that on newsstands like now in
already.
August. And things like, I don't know, the summer travel issue. This is kind of like that, but it's about movement.
Yeah, this is about endless summer. And when I was thinking about what's a weird place mm-hmm. that feels like it's sort of stuck in a season, I was thinking about Miami. So that's why I set this issue there. But also because I was thinking about movement and time. Mm-hmm. And what's a place that feels a little bit surreal, a little bit hyper-real almost, and out of time?
Yeah.
And so that's what this issue is really sort of exploring. And like, what food do you eat? Not in paradise, but in this like weird other place.
Okay. Yeah. When I look through it, I feel like I see a weird place like through your vision, through your visuals in the magazine that I wouldn't be able to pinpoint as Miami. Mm-hmm. And I know you've spent considerable time there. You've lived there for about
I lived there for about a year, mm-hmm. About 14 months. And what I discovered is that South Florida is just, I would call it lawless, really. And they just do their own thing. But all because it's a tropical zone, you get all of these amazing fruits that otherwise grow in Asian countries and other places.
Durian.
Yeah. Exactly. And all of these strange melons and just all of these things that I don't associate with the U.S.
Right.
Really. And because it's right down at the tip of Florida, you just get everybody doing their own thing and people growing these incredible heirloom things that they just kind of want to see if it's going to grow. And it does.
Mm-hmm. And so like unlike a normal maybe feature about Miami, I was shown a different side of it, but also I feel like it was a very intimately portrayed Miami because you know it very well and you're able to share that. It's not just like a travel piece. Here's the cool places. And I feel like in each of your issues, you try to talk about something that is very intimate and sort of personal to you, or you tackle a big subject by showing us those things.
Right. Well, I think it's more interesting when it has some kind of subjectivity to it. Mm-hmm. So I'm showing places that I have lived, that I do live, and thinking more about like what are things that I've eaten when I'm there? What's real food?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, the things that are in there are things that I have photographed that have come out of my kitchen or a kitchen that I'm cooking in. And so it's not just some glossy thing that sort of has little relationship to people who actually eat it.
Right, right.
You know, and some of it's still very beautiful and it's meant to be beautiful because we do eat with our eyes, but it is meant to be real.
It is. And I remember you had a few issues ago, the theme was food poisons.
Yes, dangerous food, yeah.
And, you know, that's really fascinating to me. You might expect a lot of, like, investigative journalism or something like that in it. But instead, it was this really interesting pastiche of sort of uncertainties that you come across with food.
Well, there's so many things that we don't realize are poisonous or dangerous for people because people, when I was making that, they were thinking, well, is she only going to write about pufferfish and, you know, kind of this exotic, you know, stuff that you might die from. And in fact, there's like ordinary things that are dangerous for people like fava beans. So I was more interested in that and our relationship with that kind of knowledge. You know, like I don't intentionally want to poison any of my friends, but I do want to cook for them and I need to figure out how to do that. So
that is utilitarian.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing is like Miami is this place where I had all of these very strange encounters because that's the kind of place that it is.
Right.
And so a lot of those do happen around food.
Yeah.
You know, and Miami is a tourism hub. Much sort of this place that people fly through on their way to South America.
Mm-hmm.
So you really see that in the cuisine that happens in the town. And when you get outside of the tourist areas and you get into South Florida and you get into areas that are even in downtown Miami and not on South Beach, you start to see what people who live there really eat. And Peruvian culture there is really interesting. Ecuadorian culture is really interesting there. So
very cool. So you're a great photographer, visual artist. Obviously, these issues are very conceptual, and for a magazine of this kind of high quality printing and photography, why did you go with food as a subject as opposed to, I don't know, maybe travel or fashion?
Right. Well, I mean, food lets us talk about everything, which is the nice doorway in. But for me, it's because food has been sort of the way that I've been able to get into a place and get out of a place. It's very much been sort of an escape mechanism for me to be able to figure out who I was in that moment and how to relate to people that were around me. And then for me, it's been a way to sort of carry me forward into the next place in my life.
Right.
You know, and when I turn my camera on things, there are often landscapes. But then there's also the plate, because for me, it's been learning, you know, how do I feel about what I eat every day? How do I feel every day? And so it's easiest to start looking at what you're cooking for yourself and start taking photos of that. And it's sort of developed from there. There are some photos in this issue that maybe feel a little bit at odds with what we think about in a food magazine. There's an incredible area of Miami called the Design District. And the mural culture there is just so great because, you know, somebody puts something up and then someone else adds to it and someone else adds to it. And then they create this sort of elaborate thing that altogether is much greater than the initial graffiti.
Yeah.
And so that to me says a lot about what's happening culturally there between how people are relating to each other in different neighborhoods and also how they're eating together. So it is truly like changing the business landscape and where people move and how people move around the city.
Wow. It's beautiful too. I love seeing like your shots of these very, very different, highly stylized artwork on the walls of places. But but getting back to what you're saying about is food is how you get into places and how you get out of them. Do you find like that? Do you have like any particular food restrictions that you feel like you feel accepted or like welcomed in a certain place when I don't know.
Yeah,
I wasn't
sure
with that.
For me, when I moved to Miami, well, so I drove down to Miami. I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I drove down and I brought lard with me from the farmer's market in Charlottesville because I'm that kind of food nerd. And then I was in Atlanta visiting my parents, and I double fried Krispy Kreme donuts and lard. Because that's kind of what you do in Atlanta in my parents' household. And then I was driving down to Miami, which made it even stranger as a way to enter the space. Mm-hmm. But when I got down there, I couldn't figure out sort of what I wanted to make first in the kitchen. Because for me, it's about unpacking the boxes, but also unpacking the kitchen utensils. Mm-hmm. Being like, okay, what am I going to feed myself in this space? And my comfort food is usually shrimp scampi. Like, that's the first thing that I cook.
Nice.
And when I moved to Miami, I couldn't find shrimp that I really liked that looked like normal shrimp. Mm. Because in that area, they use the bay shrimp, are an indicator species. So I was able to find those, but I walked into the fish market, and there is a photo of it, but it's a lot cleaner now than it used to be.
Yeah.
But there were these little old ladies who were maybe 4.5 feet tall. And they had these enormous fish heads that I swear were larger than they were.
Their heads.
And they were in there to buy the fish heads for Friday soup. Right.
Okay.
And so I'm watching this, and I'm going into this fish shop that I had done some online research and found, and just entering into that space and seeing them in line and finding beautiful little shrimp that were a different size than I expected. That helped me go, okay, this is really bizarre. And how am I going to do this in this space? But that was a way for me to go, okay, like this is, I'm going to make this claim.
Yeah.
And I'm going to cook shrimp scampi, and it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. And then I could move from there into like other things that I wanted to cook. But I think that we often enter a space and we're like, I know what I want to eat, or I know what I'm good at cooking.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to go, well, what actually should I be cooking here? What should I be making? What's good here?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's this
you have to
concept.
Adapt with the environment that you're in.
The same way where we cook things seasonally because they're in season, we know they'll taste
their
best.
The environment
then.
You're in.
Yeah. So when you move, you have to be like, okay, well, what's actually good here?
Right, right. Yeah. And I definitely feel that way. And there's some feeling of comfort and settling in after you've figured out how to cook in a new environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yes, I can be here now.
Yeah, it feels like an accomplishment.
Yeah. And you know, we all travel. I'm not sure how many other people cook when they travel, but it's definitely so much fun.
It's so much fun. The markets are so fun to go to and think, oh, and this is what's special here.
Right. But even, you know, by that token, when you go and you look for somewhere to sit down and eat, like at a restaurant or a food stand, you're really looking for that sense of comfort. What is good for, what's the best idea for me that is this place, this different place?
Right. And I mean, there's still the sense of novelty and how beautiful that is. And you go, oh my God, what is this? I don't know what this is. But you do want to have some kind of purchase on a place where you feel like, oh, I could do this.
Right.
I can
live here. And, you know, everyone has to eat. So, we're going to just cut to a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more with Kristen Taylor of Saucy.
Ooh, Lord, baby. Oh, baby, can't you hear me crying?
You're listening to Help Me Now by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Just one more time. Well, I admit, baby, that I was wrong.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
All right, we're back on Eat Your Words, chatting with Kristen Taylor of Saucy Magazine. So we talked a lot about the recent issue on movement. And just to back up a little bit, how hard or difficult? Well, first of all, you are the only employee of Saucy, correct?
I am. It's the shortest masthead ever. It's just me.
So you're the producer, the writer, the photographer, the publicist,
yes.
The distributor.
Mm-hmm.
How did you fund it? Like, how does that work?
Oh, yeah. So that's, well, if it does work. So I did a Kickstarter for this issue, and then I did one for the fourth issue in the fall. So the one that we talked about earlier, Dangerous Food, was number 3.
Okay.
And then the fourth one was a Kickstarter, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. That was called The Unbearable Lightness of Eating. That was the holiday issue. And then there was Black Valentine. And so the Kickstarter actually was more than funded in the fall, which was great. So I was able to use the excess funds to go toward the Valentine issue. Because the thing about publishing an indie mag is that you don't have scale,
right?
Which is how the cost can come down. Because you always have the setup fee with a printer. And I work with Prolific Group, and they're in Canada, and they're amazing. And they just, you know, they really nerd out with you on paper and print
cool.
and color. Because, I mean, you know that when you're taking photos of food, if the colors aren't right, it looks really unappetizing.
It could be bad.
It's gross. So we had to really play with it to get the paper stock right and to make it really feel good. And then I did a Kickstarter for this one. And I was able to do it in a 2-week Kickstarter instead of a month. Because I knew that the issue was already done. It was at the printer. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to make sure that that I was going to be able to print it and get it out. And then now I can start thinking about how it might go out into the world in different ways.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on those Kickstarter campaigns.
Yeah.
And do people like kind of like pre-order an issue when they do that as their reward? Yeah,
they do.
So that makes perfect sense. And you know how to...
It's been great. And also it's been really fun. I use the Kickstarter to send an update every day during the 2 weeks. And to give more context to the issue.
Right.
So sort of to give more background around some of the photos. Because many people who ended up backing the Kickstarter have never been to Miami.
Yeah.
So it is this place that is an unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that way it should be, I hope, a little bit richer of an experience. Because this issue is 80 pages.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really meant to be sort of you sit down with it and you spend a couple hours or maybe an hour just kind of leafing through it.
Yeah.
It doesn't lend itself quite as well as some other magazines and indie magazines do to picking up and reading one little thing and going away.
Right.
It works better when you do the whole thing in one shot.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it's working out so far. You sounded a little hesitant though at first, like if it is working out, but it's almost kind of like a subscription model.
A little bit. And I do have a subscription thing up on my, site, thesaucymag.com. But it's really with indie mags, you just go, you know what, we have to make this thing happen.
Yeah.
So you get the issue out the door and then you start worrying about the next issue.
Do you think this is a sustainable way? Because I mean, I've been hearing about everyone from authors writing cookbooks to people starting their ice cream businesses. Everyone's doing, you know, Kickstarter for a lot of different moving parts kind of projects. And it's working out so far for you.
It's been great. I mean, it's been totally amazing because this was meant to be a personal project that was just important to me.
I see.
And I made the Dangerous Food issue and then just gave it to some friends. Had some people over and said, hey, I made this thing. I want to give you one. And then I had someone say, why don't you try a Kickstarter? I said, I don't know. And then it just worked out, which was great. And that gave it the momentum to continue and brought it to a new audience that I don't think otherwise would have found it, which was great. And about 40% of the fall Kickstarter was an international audience.
Huh.
So that's really fun. That's how, you know, the internet sort of finds its
way. Yes, it does.
You know, but part of the problem is that, you know, they're so expensive to make print things, to make real things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to educate an audience, even an audience that loves you, about the true expense of the thing itself.
Right.
You know, so that, you know, you do have to do a Kickstarter and say, like, this is the big setup cost. This is the fee. Right. The magazines themselves are less, but there's still a big setup fee, and you have to divide that by the total that you're making. But it is a special thing. And I think that actually helps us when we're making indie magazines, because we have to think harder about, you know, what's actually going to be a collectible thing.
Mm-hmm.
You want to use really good paper because exactly. It's meant to last.
It definitely feels so much meant to last than most, and you know, this thin kind of like,
right,
but glossy.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I want to add is that there are no ads in this.
Right.
Is this something, would you consider doing ads in the future, maybe, to lure?
I definitely consider it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, once you get into this, you get really addicted to making magazines.
I guess so. Started as a passion project.
Right.
And, yeah.
Now I just want to keep it going.
Okay.
And so, yes, I would consider it, but I think it really would have to be something that makes sense for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you always do better when you can do less of that and something that's really on brand.
Okay.
Meaning people who want something totally different.
Right.
This, I don't think, would ever work in a mainstream way, because it's not just pretty pictures of food with recipes.
Right.
Even though I love that, too, that's not what this is. So when it's on a newsstand, what would it be around? And some of those publications that make more sense are more independent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And some lifestyle things, you know, things that are just a little bit strange.
Right.
So.
Another thing this isn't is a blog, like a Tumblr with,
right,
you know, photos or something. Did you consider that? And is this,
well, I have
deliberate,
you know, I have a couple dozen Tumblrs because I have a problem. and I love it, but this always felt to me like something that I wanted to make as a real thing. I think partly,
yeah,
because I've worked on the internet for more than a decade.
Yes.
And I wanted to have something that was like, I made this thing and I can touch it and here
that
I want
to. That is so
give you
interesting.
One. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's partly the Kickstarter in the fall was great because we I ended it and it was right before the holidays, so people could give it as gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just hard to give internet gifts, right? We work in this
it
arena.
It seems too
where,
free.
Well, yeah, it's hard to make it, it's just hard to wrap it.
I know.
Correctly.
True.
So that worked out really well. And I think also this is sort of like, I feel like doing the analog print thing makes me appreciate the online stuff even more.
I see. Yeah.
And I am thinking about ways that some of this content
could be online or
sort of different type of content that's related to it could be online, but in a different way, like as an iPad magazine, perhaps.
Maybe the recipes, you could combine those.
Right. Well, and I'm also, you know, this issue is about movement, and it's mm-hmm. like you can't put an MP3 in a print magazine. So, you know, how do you create some of these other ways that there is movement? So that would make sense for an online.
Maybe Heritage Radio can work on that.
Yes, please do.
So what was I going to say? I had something I was going to say. Oh, yes. You mentioned there's a small magazine coalition that mm-hmm. you're a member of.
Right. The Little Magazine Coalition.
And yes. How many magazines are involved? Is it regional? Is it a new thing?
It's kind of new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are maybe 12 magazines in it right now. And most of us live in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just food stuff,
right.
Although Ralph of Put an Egg on It,
yeah,
is sort of our fearless leader right now.
Cool.
And partly because that publication has also been around for a while.
And, Put an Egg on It, a food little zine.
Which is
That's
great.
Cute.
It's printed on green paper, if you've
yeah.
seen it. But then, you know, also really excellent magazines that I love, like Killscreen, which is about gamer culture. So it's not just video games, but kind of the culture around
oh, cool.
that. What does that mean? Day Job is mm-hmm. in it. And so, you know, you really have it sort of, it's a spectrum of people who are trying to make something that feels a little bit weightier.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so we do have these meetings and we're thinking about new ways to sort of distribute.
Right.
Because
where does
it make sense to do that? And I think we have more power as a group to leverage that and perhaps to even, you know, do ads or events together,
mm-hmm.
which would make more sense because, again, we don't have the luxury of scale. We're not selling millions of copies. We're making special things for small groups of people.
So are you thinking more bookstores or more maybe food stores, maybe specialty grocers?
Yeah, we have this really beautiful thing in Brooklyn where you have food stores that are really specialized, but they have print products in them
mm-hmm.
That are beyond just cookbooks.
Absolutely.
So it makes sense when you think about what should be next to each other on a shelf.
Yeah, like the Brooklyn Kitchen and so forth.
Exactly.
All right, Brooklyn Kitchen, if you're listening,
please carry
we got
saucy.
Some small magazine coalition.
We're
and
coming
saucy.
Your way.
So I should back up. I was commenting during the break, complimenting Kristen's lovely radio voice. I actually first met Kristen at a storytelling salon called The Shed at some mutual friends. And Kristen always tells a really interesting story at these events. And it just seems like you're a natural at that, just telling stories.
Thank you. I think we always look for ways to tell new stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what both of us do online.
Vocal and then visual.
They just come out in different ways. It's like, absolutely, what's the right way to tell it? The Shed is such a special thing because it's in a backyard. You feel very welcome, very safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have the right, I think, parameters around it. We should probably say that The Shed is run by Jason Fried, Audrey Evans,
and Chrysanthi Tenentes,
and then Katie Cooper. And so they just create this monthly thing that just feels wonderful to be in it because there's only really, you know, 6 or 8 speakers. The stories are 7 minutes. They have to be true and they have to be about your life.
Mm-hmm. And they're based on a theme of
right,
the month.
Which is great. So we just had the steamy summer stories one, which is fun too.
And there's always food too, which is very welcoming. And you're saying it's very different from other storytelling type of events, like, you know, public ones like the Moth. Mm-hmm. Where people just have drinks.
Right. No,
which is nice too.
I think having food really changes it. And not just bar food, but food that people, that there's a big spoon in. Mm-hmm. That people are serving
family
each other
style
out of.
Food, not past right. appetizers. Right. Like little right. bites of something. Yeah, it's very homey. You're right.
Yeah, I just like the way it feels. I think that leads to better stories.
And just to talk a little bit about your other projects, because Saucy is a passion project and a side project, and you're now a digital editor at where?
At Al Jazeera, right.
Yeah, congratulations.
So, thank you. Yeah, it's been incredible and intense. But yeah, I'm a senior digital producer for this show called Fault Lines, which is a long-form documentary program, and it airs every week on Al Jazeera America and on Al Jazeera English, which is fun, again, because it's this long-form content.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
you're able to actually spend time and meet a bunch of different characters over a 25-minute episode. That's much harder to do in like a 3-minute or 7-minute news
definitely
clip.
Definitely is. Yeah.
And that is something that actually helps me when I think about all these other kinds of projects that I work on, because I'm leading the online experience.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about a cable show, and not all of us even have cable. I don't have cable.
I don't have a TV.
I don't even know anyone who has cable. So how do we create an online experience around that, knowing that there's more than just watching the episode itself?
Mm-hmm.
So we just had a Bangladesh episode, and we were able to put up online the document trail around the episode, put up some background reading before the episode happened, put up a photo slideshow, do a live tweeting of the show with screenshots, put that up online. So people are able to find a way in. I think that's really big when you're thinking about an audience, online or off.
Right.
Is like, how do you bring people in so that they feel like they could be interested in learning more?
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a lot more work, you know, and thought that's put into it. And, you know, I was reading about Al Jazeera and U.S., and England, and how it's really focused on that hard-hitting journalism that we seem to be losing a bit of.
Right, and it's
today.
So important. And I think actually the U.S. audience is one that really wants that type of content.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really kind of hungry for it. So I'm hoping that this is a bigger launch will lead to more people accessing this content.
And such an interesting juxtaposition between your two
yes.
projects right now.
Yes, very
Saucy Magazine is... I don't know, different.
But always, I think it's a little bit subversive. Uh-huh. It's funny, I was listening to the ad that was playing and I
You're
was...
You're right, it is subversive.
Yeah, and I was thinking about when I used to live in Miami, you know, you can buy raw milk in Miami.
Oh, okay. Really?
But it has to be labeled for pet consumption only.
Uh-huh.
So everyone would always say, like, I'm going to the store to get, you know, some supplies for my 6-foot-tall pet.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, that works, I guess. no, but it is subversive, and it asks the tough questions. So thank you for doing that in this wonderful food magazine.
Thank you.
It's really exciting. I can't wait to see each new issue as it comes out. And where else can we get Saucy currently, except for what's the website?
It's thesaucymag.com.
Thesaucymag.com. Mm-hmm. Where else can we find it?
So I'm going to be selling these at the Brooklyn Flea.
Yay!
Next Saturday and the Saturday after that. And then it might be carried in some Brooklyn stores soon. Cross your fingers.
Listen, Brooklyn Kitchen.
And then we'll see. I don't know.
That sounds great. So if you want to see Kristen, meet her, chat her up at the Flea, and buy some saucy next Saturday, Fort Greene, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.